Hello and welcome to another episode of ESG Voices. This podcast series addresses the opportunities and challenges within ESG through interviews with ESG specialists from KPMG and beyond. Throughout this series, we will discuss a broad range of environmental, social, and governance issues, aiming to support governments, businesses, and communities in creating an equitable and prosperous future. In today's episode, which was originally aired on the KPMG Global Perspectives podcast series, John Michalalisi, Head of Global ESG, KPMG International, interviews the Honourable Maya Motley, the first female Prime Minister of Barbados. Together, they discuss the pressing climate crisis, how AI and tech are changing business, and the importance of engaging people when building a sustainable future. John, I am now pleased to turn it over to you.
It's great to be joined by a truly inspirational world leader on the global stage. This includes so many areas that this amazing leader is leading on, whether this be as chair of the V20, originally 20, now 68 of some of the most vulnerable countries which were impacted by climate change, whether this be spearheading World Bank reform or working with the IMF. This leader is leaning in to some of these really pressing issues to drive change and to do so at pace. I'd just like to say a big thank you for coming and welcome to Prime Minister Maya Amor Motley. Welcome.
Thank you so much, John. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on a podcast. And we're just going to jump straight in, if that's okay. So first of all, the past podcast, we're just looking back over the last decade. And when we do this, one of the things that immediately springs to mind is the impact of COVID-19, the pandemic, clearly impacted all of us all around the world. But just maybe you'd like to understand what learnings you took from Barbados on the impact of the pandemic.
Oh, so many. I mean, the pandemic made bear so many things that we suspected were there and that we needed to address, just the value of who we valued in terms of workers. All of a sudden, you begin to realize that people who you didn't see or didn't hear or didn't feel all along were now critical to your existence, whether they were sanitation workers, whether they were essential workers working in water and transport, whatever. Secondly, it made us not take for granted the things that we were taking for granted for so long. And for those of us who live in countries dependent on visitors, on tourism, it was even a more stark reality because we understood that we probably have, even though the direct contribution of tourism to GDP is supposed to be between 15 and 18% on average, the truth is it's more like 40 to 45%. In terms of the purchasing power that it generates, because you have what in our case, almost three times our population come as long stay visitors and four times our population as cruise visitors for a day. So you begin to realize that the combination of the two created this large public that all of a sudden were not there, and therefore jobs and purchasing power and everything dropped and declined. At the same time, you're managing your actual exposure to the health realities on something that you can't see nor feel because, and then this whole notion of physical distancing and social distancing becomes a reality. But then out of every crisis comes opportunities too. Absolutely. And we saw the opportunity for the digital world to keep us connected in a very real way. We saw the opportunity for workers who, as I said, were not hitherto seen or valued all of a sudden to receive the value and the benefit of our appreciation during that difficult period. And we begin to take less for granted what we must do to prepare for the future. I mean, everybody just assumes that the future will happen or pensions will be there or whatever. And then you begin to realize that you do need a lifeline, whether it is unemployment benefits, social security benefits, whatever. And are we in fact planning for them? Or is the world beginning to suffer from what the developed world is suffering from, which is a declining and an aging population? And that then creates other scenarios that we haven't started to address. And when we combine that with the very unfortunate attitudes towards migrants and migration, which in previous times would have allowed us to smooth out some of the gaps and deficits, we begin to see that we need to pause and really understand what we learned from it, what we can do better, and what we need not to repeat going forward. And I'd like to embrace all of this in the context of us recognizing that this is a time for moral strategic leadership globally. And I think the pandemic just reinforced the absolute need for it, whether we're dealing with that, or we're dealing with the climate crisis, or we're dealing with geopolitics, or we're dealing with domestic social implosion. These things are now all critical.
I've never actually heard that said that way, Prime Minister, about, people, certainly in the UK, we talked about key workers. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to focus maybe on nurses and doctors because you interact with them. But then the whole scope of key workers seemed to grow. And you think about, well, actually, refuge collection, that's kind of important too. So it was amazing just how that really came into the spotlight. And maybe if I just think about those workers and maybe looking ahead to the future, talent of the future, what measures will Barbados take to equip the workforce of the future? Thinking about those skills, whether it be technology and AI and so on, it would be good just to understand also, are there any emerging industries that you're currently leading?
Well, I think that the whole digitization is, we've been all hurled into that arena. We were going there naturally, but the pandemic just made it all the more urgent and people just went in, even if they weren't ready for it. And that brings us to recognizing that we have to go back and prepare for the threats, the cybersecurity threats and the other exposure that that puts us in danger of suffering from. At the same time, the power of AI is both dazzling but frightening. And we have to ensure that regulation in all of these things is there to protect the majority of us. The other thing that COVID highlighted was the Wild Wild West predominated, and we could not get, even if you had the money, our orders were simply too small to be seen. There were some realities that hit us very strong, but what it did for us was it brought us closer to Africa, because when others weren't prepared to listen and to pay attention and to work with us, those of us who were vulnerable realized that there was strength in unity, and the Africa Medical Supplies platform was created to be able to allow for pooled procurement of therapeutics and vaccines and equipment. And this, therefore, when extended to the Caribbean countries, meant that a country as small as St. Kitts and Nevis, with a population of 38,000, could access goods at the same price as a country as large as Nigeria with over 200 million people. So it brought to us some benefits that I would like to think that we will continue to use going forward. The digitization is there, but it also made us realize that with as much power as the digital economy and the digital society has, it can't care for you. And therefore, nurses and a whole bunch of other care workers taking care of the elderly and the most vulnerable in our society are still going to be needed more than ever. So it was a wake-up call as to what potentially the future could look like. And as you correctly said, it has allowed us, therefore, to make decisions on where we place our investments. We are now, for example, expanding significantly our training in nursing, not because we are catering only to our domestic population, but the world feels the same way as we do. And you would see that there's a shortage of nurses globally throughout, and it's unlikely that a robot is going to ever be able to care for a human being in the same way that a nurse will. So there's some professions that will, for example, dominate, and then there are others that are at risk, including my own.
Surely not Prime Minister.
The legal, not the politics as much, because I think regrettably or fortunately, there will always be need for people to interpret policy and to lead other human beings. But in terms of law, a lot of the repetitive tasks in law and medicine, etc., are now going to be taken care of by digital revolution and AI. So it's an interesting time. The question may well be, who owns the robots, rather than will you have robots or not? And once we can ensure that the democratization of the digitization is available to all, while at the same time having the regulation that's necessary to avoid the fake news, to avoid the negative use of information and the digital revolution in a way that hurts people. If we can get that balance right, then I think that it'll be an exciting time. I don't want to tell you to go and watch the Jetsons again, but the truth is that perhaps when we were kids gave us more of an accurate insight into what today's world could look like than we even ever dreamt was possible probably at that time.
That's interesting. And maybe if we just stay, Prime Minister, with the whole digital revolution. One of the things that we've read is Barbados is one of the most technology, if not the most technology advanced country in the Caribbean. And I'd just like to understand how you're positioning Barbados and the hub for startups in the future. And, you know, taking the time to learn those lessons, but then also having the follow through, acting upon those and doing so at pace. I'd just like to understand, you talked before, digital was really thrust into the spotlight also during the pandemic. But moving forwards, how are you seeking to grow that? And what incentives are you seeking to put in place at a policy and other levels in Barbados?
Well, I think that in terms of the incentives, we've put incentives in place, both in terms of tax incentives or access to funding during the COVID crisis. We put a special BEST program in place for funding of some of the hotels, mainly the locally owned hotels would have sought to have benefited from it. But it was contingent upon digitization and training and greening as well. And it's not yet carried us fully where we want to go. So we're still working with those entities. In the budget speech earlier this year, I also announced that those who were prepared to do digitization within the next year or so would get the benefit of tax credits. We also recognize that giving our people access to skills is absolutely critical. So separate from the community technology programs we do, we've also, for example, as a government, paid Coursera through our National Transformation Initiative to make 15,000 courses available free of charge to any Bajan who wants to benefit. We've been working with Canadians in terms of cybersecurity and AI type training, particularly for young people, but also for people who may be in their 50s, who may have been laid off of a job and who can become a global citizen within the context of filling the gap where there's a deficit of skills globally in areas of cybersecurity and AI. So we've been working with a number of entities to provide that training and those opportunities beyond our boundaries for our citizens to play their role. So there are a number of things that we can do in terms of tax incentives, in terms of jobs, in terms of training, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of stronger regulation and legislation. But we have to be prepared to test and fix, because with the best will in the world, we're not going to be able to predict every combination or permutation of problems. And therefore, the notion of being nimble is going to be absolutely critical for a small state such as ours if we're going to stay above the fray and not be sucked into a vortex, because it's certainly powerful enough that it can do so. And you need to be able to make sure that you have access to funding that can prepare your people in the image of their cultural mores, and so as not to lose their cultural identity, because it's so easy for everyone just to become global citizens while forgetting their local roots. And therefore the balance is, how do you do all of these things that allow you, yes, to be a global citizen, but never takes you away from your traditional roots as a Bajan, as a Jamaican, as a Caribbean person, as an African, as an Asian, as whoever.
I love that. And this is, it's really at the center of something I passionately believe in, holding two things to be true, both diversity and unity at the same time, and holding them as both and. So I absolutely love that. So Prime Minister, I'm going to take us to a slightly different topic, and one that I know you are very passionate about climate change and about sustainability. And it is that term climate change that you're not particularly happy about that term. You prefer climate crisis, but is that maybe a little bit alarmist, Prime Minister?
Not if you're a victim of it. And regrettably, there's probably very few countries in the world that have not been in some way affected by the climate crisis. We're in the state of California as we speak. And as we speak, wildfires are flaring across in the country next door in Canada. Earlier this year, they've suffered significantly from wildfires. You saw it in Greece this year. Let's go to hurricanes. Beryl became the earliest and fastest developing hurricane of the hurricane season in the Americas. And in so doing, it didn't hit Barbados, but it decimated 90% of my fishing industry, destroyed my fishing harbor, destroyed our beaches, destroyed jetties. We're now moving to fix that back. And yet we were not the worst hit as countries like St. Vincent and the Grenadines and Union Island and Mayo and in Grenada and Caracou. They were hit much worse than us in terms of the destruction of houses. So this thing is very much a crisis. And you will hear me speak about very often about things slowly becoming more and more difficult to access insurance. And when a country, a sector, or a region can't access insurance, then they become uninvestable and not only uninsurable, because to get a mortgage, you need insurance. To get a loan for your hotel to fix it up, you need insurance. To get a loan for your small business, you need insurance. So these things are now beginning to affect the microeconomy. The difference between us and large countries such as the US and Canada and in Europe is that they don't face wipeout risk within a day or two, but we can face wipeout risk within a day or two. You only have to go back to Hurricane Maria and Irma, all within a short period of time in Dominica. And in Maria's case, 226% of GDP wiped out overnight. So these things are a crisis for us. We say we are the canaries in the mine only because we'll get it first, but not last, nor largest. But we should use the opportunity of helping to build the resilience in small states such as ours to show you what is potentially possible in larger countries who do have coastal communities, who do have far more people that will be made vulnerable as a result of the climate crisis than we could ever have. And if we took it seriously and partnered together in terms of policy, in terms of access to finance, in terms of procurement of goods, procurement of new technology, we then can find a possible plan that can help us meet this date with destiny that is probably about a decade away. And I say that because if we go beyond the 1.5 degree increase in temperature, we are likely to see not everyone, but a large number of people, particularly in vulnerable communities, being affected in terms of their livelihoods first, but some in terms of their lives.
And just on that, this connects really with your chair role of the V20. And I'd ask, what is your hope for the V20? You talked about the importance of partnering, but if you, what is the best case scenario for that 10-year period you referenced?
There are still three major areas of action when it comes to the climate. There is the need for us to adapt and build resilience, which is predominantly public sector, but some private sector as well, because a hotel can do things to adapt in terms of its hotel on the coast to be able to minimize its losses. But it's predominantly the public sector. And in our own case, we say from roofs to reefs. So if you don't fix the roofs that you have a housing catastrophe when the passage of a hurricane is over. You go to your reefs. If you don't fix your reefs, you have the potential for coastal incursion, saltwater incursion into your aquifers, which means those aquifers are gone forever and the livelihood of the people living there is threatened. At the same time, you have climate mitigation. And remember, mitigation can take place any part of the world. It doesn't have to take place in the north, the south. It can take place anywhere. And by having climate mitigation, we really ought to be financing the projects globally that offer the greatest potential impact on climate mitigation, irrespective of where they've come from and who is the sponsor, because the world starts to benefit from that. And the third aspect, of course, is regrettably the loss and damage is hurting. And what has happened is that most countries, in fact, a lot of our countries as small states, have had increased debt to GDP ratios without people recognizing that a lot of the increased debt has come from having to deal with these consequences of the climate over the last 20, 30 years without calling it that.
Yeah, not created by those countries.
That's not created by us, but you've got to respond, and you've had to respond in the last 20, 30 years, and you've had to put institutional mechanisms in place that take money that would otherwise be going to education and health. So when you begin to understand loss and damage, you will recognize that this is fundamentally a case of equity and justice, and that these countries should not, Grenada, Carriacou, St. Vincent, the Grenadines, Barbados, all of us should not have to be now looking to go and increase our debt to be able to deal with a crisis that has been caused by the profligate behavior of others, particularly in the industrial north. But if you manage those three, mitigation, adaptation and resilience building, and loss and damage, and very often people conflate the three without appreciating the difference. I'll give you one last point, because we keep talking about greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide. In the last year and a half, you've heard a lot more about methane.
Yes.
And you've heard a lot more about methane because methane actually does far more damage.
Impact.
And if we can get a global methane agreement, I think Sultan Al-Jaber did well in COP28 to get a voluntary compact. But we need to go further now and make this a legal agreement, just as we did in the past when we were dealing with air conditioners and et cetera, with the Alas Montreal Protocol. If we can do that, then we can stave off the rate at which we are likely to come closer to 1.5 on a sustained basis. Because we've hit 1.5 already.
Yes.
It's just not sustained. We want to avoid the sustained temperature of that. And regrettably, at this rate at which we're going, the end of this century looks like 3 degrees more and not 1.5 more. So these are real issues, and we've got to confront them and recognize that we have a date with destiny that is time-driven.
Prime Minister, I can only just truly from the heart thank you for your leadership, your passion, the precision through which you grasp some of these thorny issues, not shying away, but leaning into them. And I think it's truly wonderful. I think it's truly inspiring. And there's so much we can all learn from this. Maybe if I move on to the final question for me around making a difference, and you're making so much of a difference in terms of all of what we've just talked about. Mm-hmm. But I just want to touch a little bit on, Prime Minister, you've won two landslide elections, not one, but two. In the political arena, really not easy at all. And, you know, really thinking about all of what we've just talked about, it is so important that we take people along with us. We drive that momentum. And I'd just like to hear from you, just your thoughts on those two landslide victories. If there's anything, any secret sauce, as it were, that you could, or words of wisdom that you could pass on to others who are really seeking to inspire others to drive change and so on. So any thoughts from that would be incredibly helpful.
There's no secret magic. I think that there are a couple of things that we were taught as children that we need to remember and not feel that because we've become adults, they're no longer important. We need to hear people and we need to feel people. We will not always be able to do everything that needs to be done, but we must understand context and we must give voice to other perspectives that will allow us to be able to see how best we can create a win-win situation for as many people as possible. Having said that, there will be times when difficult decisions have to be made. And I keep making the point, if you don't take care of a problem with a nail in your foot as a diabetic when it is early, you run the risk ultimately of not just losing your entire leg, but you run the risk of sepsis and losing your life. So there's nothing to be gained from shying away from the difficult problems and decisions that have to be made. So fundamentally, it is about people and principles. And I don't think you can get away from it. And if we remember to be guided by that and remember that you're not always going to get it right, but no one said you were omnipotent nor omniscient. And the ability to recognize when you're wrong or you need to change course or you need to test and fix is also as important as strong, bold, decisive leadership. And then finally, you can't cross a chasm with small steps. Sometimes bold leadership is required. And I think that at this time in the world's existence, when there are so many things conspiring to distract, we need to be bold, recognizing that none of those things are going to stop a hurricane, a drought, or any of the other negative things that stand to affect livelihoods and lives in the climate crisis. None of those things are going to automatically stop a pandemic. None of those things are going to immediately bridge the gap that AI can literally create from respect to who we are and what we do as humans. And as I said, it's both dazzling but also daunting. And we have to be able to use principles and our commitment to people to guide us on these very difficult paths. When we first came to office in 2018, the government went beyond its five-year term to the longest possible time that it could. We were the third most indebted country in the world. Within 1 week of coming to office, and we had sewage on the streets, but within 1 week of coming to office, I called the then head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, and said, look, we're going to announce selective credit default tomorrow on our debt, and we're going to announce coming to the IMF, not because we want to, but because we have to. And in so doing, let us remember that if you're going to take people on a long journey, you need to give them a little breakfast, because without breakfast, they can't make that long journey with you. Structural adjustment or difficult decisions need the buy-in of the majority of the population. It means communication. It means listening. It means seeing. It means hearing. It means feeling them. And I think that all we therefore try to do is to apply the principles that have worked for us as individuals to live the good life in the right way, according to the principles and the compassion that we need to be part of the human race. And if we do that on a bigger scale, in a company, in a community, or in a country, then I believe that while there may be some differences on scale, for the most part, the approach will carry you home successfully.
Prime Minister.
So there's no magic.
No magic, but maybe what I would say in closing, in a world which is focused on immediacy bias, the short term, the, you know, what you can read, you know, the quick couple of clicks.
Instant fixes.
Yeah, instant fixes. The quick answers to complex solutions, you truly exemplify bold leadership. And I'd like to thank you for taking the time for, you know, appearing. Now, I know how busy you are appearing on our CEO Outlook podcast. And thank you for all that you're doing, not only within Barbados, but far beyond the shores of the island state.
Thank you. I want to thank you, John, because as you know, being an accounting firm, among other things, that we're living in a world that has prevented tremendous challenges to small states such as ours, who depend on tourism and financial services, and where the rules are changed upon us every year or two. We've taken some difficult decisions recently to be able to ensure that there's no reputational risk of blacklisting, that we will work within the context of the OECD and the Pillar 2 framework, and to work to make sure that people can do business, local and global business, from Barbados without ring fencing, but in a way that sees an opportunity both at the corporate level for people to reinvest after they pay their taxes, which are not exorbitant at 9 or 15% when they top up, but at the same time, with specifically targeted incentives that are certain enough that people can make decisions, whether it's on jobs or whether it's on ESG or whether it's on innovation. And at the same time, make sure that we also are fair to the workers and give them a level of being able to retain some of their income in a major way, rather than just believing that we only need a good tax deal for the company and not for the people who make the company.
So it's equity, fairness at its heart. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, John, and the Honourable Maya Motley. Join us again next time for more insights from ESG leaders and innovators. You can also find the latest KPMG insights covering a range of ESG topics by visiting kpmg.com/ESG. Thanks for listening.